like the previous building, mailboxes stood in a line at the back. Near the front, the air conditioner rattled and buzzed while the door to an old cage elevator stood open, like mesh jaws waiting to snap me up. I bypassed the elevator in favor of the stairs. The building had a lonely, derelict feel to it, a place where neighbors minded their own business, a place where nobody knew anyone else, and secrets were easy to keep. The third floor was dead calm. I walked past apartments 31, 32, and 33. At the back of the hall, I found apartment number 34. I suddenly wondered what I was going to do if Patch was home. At this point, I could only hope he wasn't. I knocked, but there was no answer. I tried the door handle. To my surprise, it gave. I peeked inside at darkness. I stood motionless, listening for movement. I flipped on the light switch just inside the door, but either the light bulbs had burned out or the electricity had been shut off. Pulling the flashlight out of my jacket, I let myself in and shut the door. The rancid smell of spoiled food overwhelmed me. I aimed the flashlight in the direction of the kitchen, a skillet with days-old scrambled eggs and a partially full gallon of milk that had soured to the point of bloating sat on the counter. It wasn't the kind of place I imagined Patch calling home, but this only proved there were many things I didn't know about him. I set my keys and handbag on the counter and pulled my shirt up over my nose in an attempt to block out the stench. The walls were bare, the furniture sparse. One antiquated TV with rabbit ears, probably black and white, and a ratty sofa in the living room. Both were out of view of the window, which had butcher paper taped across it. Keeping the flashlight beam low, I made my way down the hall to the bathroom. It was stark, other than a beige shower curtain that had probably started out white, and a dingy hotel towel draped over the rod. No soap, no razor, no shaving cream. The linoleum floor was peeling back at the edges, and the medicine cabinet over the sink was empty. I continued down the hall to the bedroom. I turned the knob and pushed the door inward. The stale smell of sweat and unwashed bed clung to the air. Since the lights were off, I figured it was safe to raise the blinds, and I forced the window open, allowing fresh air inside. A streetlight's glow trickled in, casting a hazy gray around the room. Dishes caked with dried food were stacked on the nightstand, and while the bed had sheets, they lacked the crisp look of freshly laundered linens. In fact, judging by the smell, they hadn't seen laundry soap in months. A small desk with a computer monitor sat in the back corner. The actual computer was gone, and it occurred to me that Patch had taken great care not to leave any trace of himself behind. I crouched in front of the desk, opening and closing drawers. Nothing struck me as out of the ordinary. Pencils and a copy of the Yellow Pages. I was about to close the door when a small black jewelry box taped to the underside of the desk caught my eye. I ran my hand under the desk, blindly peeling the box free from the tape holding it in place. I lifted the lid. Every hair on my body stood on end. The box held six of the Black Hand's rings. At the far end of the hall, the front door creaked open. I shot to my feet. Had Patch returned? I couldn't let him find me. Not now, not when I'd just discovered the Black Hand's rings in his apartment. I looked around for somewhere to hide. The twin-size bed stood between me and the closet. If I tried to walk around the bed, I risked being seen from the doorway. If I climbed over the bed, I risked the bed springs squeaking. The front door closed with a soft click. Solid footsteps crossed the linoleum in the kitchen. Seeing no other choice, I boosted myself onto the windowsill, swung my legs out, and dropped as silently as possible onto the fire escape. I tried to pull the window shut behind me, but the sliders stuck, refusing to budge. I ducked all but my eyes below the window, keeping them trained inside the apartment. A shadow appeared on the hall wall, stretching closer. I ducked out of sight. I was scared that this was it. I was going to be caught. When the footsteps retreated. Less than a minute later, the front door opened, closed. An eerie silence once again settled over the apartment. Slowly, I brought myself back to standing. I stayed that way another minute, and when I was certain the apartment was in fact empty, I crawled back inside. Feeling suddenly conspicuous and vulnerable, I strode down the hall. I needed to go somewhere quiet, where I could sort through my thoughts. What was I missing? Patch was clearly the Black Hand, but how did he play into the Nephilim Blood Society? What was his role? What the hell was going on? I threw my handbag over my shoulder and headed for the exit. I had my hand on the doorknob when a strange noise penetrated my thoughts. A clock. The soft, rhythmic tick of a clock. I frowned and turned back to the kitchen. The sound hadn't been there when I came in. At least, I didn't think it had. Listening intently, I followed the muffled tick across the room. I crouched down in front of the cabinet below the kitchen sink. With growing alarm, I opened the cabinet. Through all the panic and confusion, I made sense of the contraption sitting inches from my knees. Sticks of dynamite, duct tape, white, blue, and yellow wires. I stumbled to my feet and ran out the front door. My feet clattered down the stairs so fast I had to hold the handrail to keep from falling. At the bottom, I shoved my way out to the street and kept running. Flipping my head back once, I saw a snap of light an instant before fire erupted from the windows of the third floor of the building. Smoke billowed up in the night. Debris of bricks and wood, glowing orange with heat, hailed down to the street. The faraway sound of sirens ricocheted off the buildings, and I alternately speed-walked and ran to the next block, terrified of drawing attention, but too distraught not to flee the scene. When I rounded the corner, I broke into a wild sprint. I didn't know where I was going. My pulse was all over the place, my thoughts reeling. If I'd stayed in the apartment another few minutes, I'd be dead. A shuddering sob escaped me. My nose was running, my stomach cramping. I wiped my eyes with the back of my hand and tried to focus on the shapes jumping out of the darkness ahead. Street signs, parked cars, the curb, the deceptive shimmer of lamplight on windows. In a matter of seconds, the world had turned into a confusing labyrinth. The truth there and not there, shifting out beneath my feet, vanishing when I tried to look it head-on. Had someone tried to blow up evidence left in the apartment? Like the Black Hand's rings? Was Patch responsible? Ahead, a gas station came into view. I staggered around to the outside bathroom and locked myself inside. My legs were wobbly, and my fingers trembled so hard it was all I could do to coordinate turning on the faucet. I splashed frigid water on my face to startle me out of sliding into shock. Bracing my arms on the sink, I breathed in gulps and gasps. Chapter 21. I hadn't slept in over 36 hours, except for very briefly Thursday evening when Patch had met me inside my dream. Staying awake through the night hadn't been a struggle. Every time I felt my eyes dipping closed, the explosion would blaze across my mind, jolting me upright. Unable to sleep, I'd spent the night thinking about Patch. When Rickson had told me Patch was the Black Hand, he'd planted a seed of doubt inside me that had swollen and blossomed with the worst kind of violation of trust. But it hadn't choked me completely. Not yet. There was still a part of me that wanted to weep and shake my head adamantly at the idea that Patch could have killed my dad. I bit my lip hard, concentrating on the pain there, rather than remembering all the times he'd stroked my mouth with his finger or kissed the curve of my ear. I couldn't think about those things. I hadn't bothered crawling out of bed at 7 for summer school. I'd left a series of phone messages for Detective Basso throughout the morning, then the afternoon, and on into the evening, one call every hour, none of which he'd returned. I told myself I was calling to check on Scott, but deep down, I suspected I just wanted to know the police were close. As much as I disliked Detective Basso, I felt a tiny bit safer believing he was only a phone call away, because a small part of me was beginning to believe maybe last night wasn't about destroying evidence. What if someone had tried to kill me? In the middle of all the thinking I'd done last night, I'd shifted around the fragments of information I had, trying to make something fit. The one clear fragment I kept coming back to was the Nephilim Blood Society. Patch said Chauncey's successor wanted to avenge his death. Patch swore nobody could trace Chauncey's death back to me, but I was beginning to fear otherwise. If the successor knew about me, maybe last night had been his first stab at revenge. It seemed unlikely that anyone had followed me to Patch's apartment so late last night, but if there was one thing I knew about Nephilim, it was that they were very good at doing the unlikely. My cell rang in my pocket and I whipped it out before the first ring had time to finish. Hello?
Let's go to summer solstice, V said. We'll eat a little cotton candy, catch a few rides, maybe get hypnotized and do stuff that would make Girls Gone Wild look tame.
My heart, which had been up in my throat, slid back into place. Not Detective Basso, then.
Hey. What say you? You in the mood for some action? You in the mood for Delphic?
Honestly, I wasn't. I'd planned on redialing Detective Basso at 60-minute intervals until he picked up one of my calls.
Earth to Babe.
I'm not feeling well, I said.
Not feeling well how? Stomach ache? Headache? Cramps? Food poisoning? Delphic is the cure for just about all those things. I'm going to pass. Thanks anyway.
Is this because of Scott? Because he's in jail. He can't get to you. Come have fun.
Rixon and I won't kiss in front of you if that's what's bothering you.
I'm going to put on my PJs and watch a movie.
Are you saying a movie is more fun than me?
Tonight it is.
Huh. Movie this? You know I'm not going to stop harassing you until you come.
I know.
So make this easy and just say yes.
I blew out a sigh. I could sit home all night and wait for Detective Basso to get around to answering my calls, or I could take a small break and start up again when I got back. Besides, he had my cell phone number and could reach me anywhere.
All right, I told V. Give me 10.
In my bedroom, I squeezed into a pair of toothpick jeans, pulled on a graphic tee and cardigan, and finished the look with suede driving mocks. I smoothed my hair into a low ponytail, offsetting it so it hung over my right shoulder. Having not slept in more than a full day, my eyes were ringed by smoky circles. I brushed on mascara, silver eyeshadow, and lip gloss, hoping I looked more pulled together than I felt. I left a rather bland note on the kitchen counter for my mom, telling her I'd gone to summer solstice at Delphic. She wasn't due back until tomorrow morning, but she surprised me more often than not by coming home early. If she did make it home tonight, this was probably going to be one time when she wished she'd drawn out her trip. I'd been practicing what I was going to say to her. Whatever I did, I couldn't break eye contact when I told her I knew about her affair with Hank, and I couldn't let her get a word in before I told her I was moving out. As I'd practiced it, I planned to walk out at that point. I wanted to send her the message that it was too late to talk. If she'd wanted to tell me the truth, she'd had 16 years to do it. Now it was too late. I locked up and jogged down the drive to meet V. An hour later, V squeezed the neon into a parking spot between two oversized trucks that extended into our space on both sides. We rolled down the windows and boosted ourselves out backward to keep from scratching the paint by opening the doors. We crossed the parking lot and paid our way inside the gates. The park was more crowded than usual due to summer solstice, the longest day of the year. Right away, I recognized a few faces from school, but for the most part, I felt like I was standing in a sea of strangers. Most of the crowd was wearing jewel-toned butterfly masks that concealed half their faces. One of the vendors must have been selling them at a discount.
"Where should we start?" V asked. "The arcade? The fun house? The food vendors?"
"Personally, I think we should start with the food. That way we'll eat less."
"Your logic?"
"If we stop by the vendors last, we'll have worked up our appetites. I always eat more when I've worked up an appetite." I didn't care where we started. I was only here to distract myself for a couple of hours. I checked my cell, but there were no missed calls. How long did it take Detective Basso to return a call? Had something happened to him? I had a black cloud hanging at the back of my mind, and I didn't like how it made me feel ill at ease.
"You look all pasty," V said.
"I told you I don't feel great."
"That's because you haven't eaten enough. Sit down. I'll go get us some cotton candy and hot dogs. Just think about all that relish and mustard. I don't know about you, but I can already feel my head clearing and my pulse slowing."
"I'm not hungry, V."
"Of course you're hungry. Everybody's hungry. That's why they've got all these vendors."
Before I could stop her, she marched into the crowd. I was pacing the walkway waiting for V when my cell phone chirped. Detective Basso's name showed on the screen.
"Finally,"
I breathed, flipping the cell open.
"Nora, where are you?"
he said the moment I picked up. He was speaking fast, and I could tell he was upset.
"Scott escaped. He got away. We've got the whole force looking for him, but I want you to stay the hell away from him. I'm coming to pick you up until this blows over. I'm on my way to your house right now."
My throat constricted, making it hard to force words out.
"What? How did he get out?"
Detective Basso hesitated before answering.
"He bent the bars in his cell."
Of course he did. He was Nephilim. 2 months ago, I'd watched Chauncey mangle my cell phone with a mere squeeze of his hand. It didn't seem too unrealistic to imagine Scott using his Nephilim strength to break out of jail.
"I'm not at home," I said.
"I'm at Delphic Amusement Park." Without meaning to, I cast my eyes over the crowd looking for Scott. But there was no way he could know I was here. After breaking out of jail, he'd probably gone directly to my house, expecting to find me there. I felt incredibly grateful to V for dragging me out tonight. Scott was probably at my house right this very minute. The cell slipped a notch through my hand. The note. On the counter. The one I'd left for my mom, telling her I'd gone to Delphic.
"I think he knows where I am," I told Detective Basso, feeling the first licks of panic. How soon can you get here?
Delphic? 30 minutes. Go to security. Whatever you do, keep your phone on you. If you see Scott, call me immediately.
They don't have security at Delphic, I said, my mouth gone to dust. It was widely known that the park didn't employ security, which was one of many reasons why my mom didn't like me coming here.
Then get out of there, he barked. Drive back to Coldwater and meet me at the station. Can you do that?
Yes, I could do that. V would give me a ride. I was already walking in the direction she'd departed, eyes raking the crowd for her. Detective Basso exhaled.
You're gonna be fine. Just hurry back here. I'll send the rest of the force to Delphic to go after Scott. We'll find him.
The anxiety in his voice didn't console me. I hung up. Scott was out. The police were on their way, and this was all going to end fine. As long as I got out now. I sketched a quick plan. First, I had to find V. I also had to get out of the open. If Scott came walking down the path right this moment, he would see me. I was jogging toward the food vendors when my ribs were elbowed from behind. Something about the force of the elbowing told me this was more than an accident. I turned, and before I'd come full circle, my brain prickled as it registered a familiar face. The first thing I noticed was the flash from the silver hoop in his ear. The second thing I noticed was how beat up his face was. His nose was broken, crooked and bruised deep red. The bruise spread below both eyes, turning a deep violet. The next thing I knew, Scott had me by the elbow and was steering me down the walkway.
"Get your hands off me!"
I said, wrestling against him. But Scott was stronger, and his grip held.
"Sure, Nora, after you tell me where it is."
"Where what is?" I said, my voice passive-aggressive. He laughed humorlessly. I kept my expression as opaque as I could, but my thoughts were racing. If I told him the ring was at my home, he'd leave the park. He'd probably drag me with him. When the police arrived, they'd find us both gone. It wasn't like I could call Detective Basso and tell him we were headed to my place. Not with Scott standing over me. No, I had to keep him here, in the park.
"Did you give it to V's boyfriend? Did you think he could protect it from me? I know he's not normal."
Scott's eyes held that same terrified uncertainty.
"I know he can do things other people can't."
"Like you?" Scott glared down at me.
"He's not like me. He's not the same. That much I can tell. I'm not going to hurt you, Nora. All I need is the ring. Give it to me and you'll never see me again."
He was lying. He would hurt me. He was desperate enough to break out of jail. Nothing was too extreme at this point. He would get the ring back no matter the cost. Adrenaline pumped through my legs and I couldn't think clearly. But somewhere in the back of my mind, my sense of survival told me I needed to take charge of the situation. I needed to find a way to separate myself from Scott. Blindly following my instincts, I said, "I have the ring."
"I know you have it," he said impatiently. "Where?"
"It's here. I brought it with me." He considered me for a moment, then yanked my handbag off my arm and ripped it open, searching it. I shook my head. "I threw it away." He shoved the handbag back at me and I caught it, clutching it against my chest.
"Where?" he demanded.
"A trash can near the entrance," I said automatically. "Inside one of the women's restrooms."
"Show me."
As we made our way down the walkway, I ordered myself to stay calm long enough to figure out my next move. Could I run? No, Scott would catch me. Could I hide out in one of the women's restrooms? Not indefinitely, no. Scott wasn't timid, and he wouldn't have a problem going in after me if it meant getting what he wanted. I still had my cell phone, however. In the women's room, I could call Detective Basso. "This one," I said, pointing at one of the cinderblock shelters. The entrance to the women's room was straight ahead, down a sloping stretch of cement with the men's room around the back. Scott grabbed me by the shoulders and shook me.
"Don't lie to me. They'll kill me if I lose it. If you're lying to me, I'll..."
He caught himself, but I knew what he'd been about to say. "If you're lying to me, I'll kill you." "It's in the bathroom." I nodded, more to convince myself I could do this than to reassure him. "I'll go get it, and then you'll leave me alone, right?" Instead of answering, Scott shoved out a hand, catching me in the navel.
"Your cell."
My heart fumbled. Seeing no other choice, I retrieved my phone and held it out to him. My hand shook slightly, but I steadied it, refusing to let him know I'd had a plan, or that he'd just shattered it.
"You've got 1 minute. Don't try anything stupid."
Inside the restroom, I made a quick survey. 5 sinks against one wall and 5 stalls opposite them. 2 college-age girls were at the sinks, a foam of bubbles covering their hands. There was a small window on the far wall and it was cranked open. Without eating up any more time, I got my foot up on the last sink and pulled myself to standing.
The window was level with my elbows now, and while there wasn't a screen to block me, it was going to be a tight fit to squeeze through. I could feel the eyes of everyone on me, but I ignored them and hoisted myself up on the ledge, hardly aware of the splattered bird poop or spider webs. When I pushed on the open window pane, it popped free and fell to the ground outside with a clatter. I sucked in a breath, thinking Scott had heard, but the crowds out on the walkways had stifled the sound. Propping my stomach on the windowsill, I lifted my left leg up, cramming it against my body until I was able to roll it through the window. I wiggled the rest of the way through, my right leg sliding out last. I hung from the windowsill by my fingers, then dropped to the sidewalk outside. I stayed in a crouch a moment, half expecting Scott to round the building. Then I ran toward the park's main walkway and slipped inside the stream of the crowd. Chapter 22. Darkness was stretching across the sky, eclipsing the pale streaks of light fanning out from the horizon. I walked in a hurry toward the park's exit. I could see the gates ahead, almost there. I was pushing through the fringe of the crowd when I came up short. Less than 200 feet away, Scott was pacing the gates, his eyes sweeping the crush of bodies pouring in and out of the gates. He'd figured out I'd escaped the bathroom and was blocking the only way out of the park. A high chain-link fence topped with barbed wire encircled the park, and the only way I was getting out was through the exit gates. I knew it, and Scott knew it. I turned abruptly and melted back into the crowd, checking behind me every few seconds to make sure Scott hadn't spotted me. I worked my way deeper into the park, on the assumption that the last place I had seen Scott was at the gates, and it was in my best interest to get as far away from them as I could. I could hide in the darkness of the funhouse until the police arrived. Or I could take the skyride above the park, where I might be able to see Scott below and keep an eye on him. As long as he didn't look up, I'd be fine. Of course, if he did see me, I had no doubt he'd be waiting for me at the end of the ride. I decided to keep moving, stay in the heaviest pockets of traffic, and wait this out. The walkway split at the Ferris wheel, one path branching off toward the water rides, the other leading to the Archangel roller coaster. I'd just veered onto the latter when I saw Scott. He saw me, too. We were on parallel walkways, the chairlift to the skyride separating us. A boy and girl took their seats on a chair as it swung around the conveyor, momentarily breaking our eye contact. I took that moment to run. I shoved my way through the crowd, but the walkways were congested, making it hard to move faster than stop and go. Worse, the walkways in this section of the park were lined with high hedges, squeezing traffic through the labyrinth of twists and turns. I didn't dare look behind me, but I knew Scott couldn't be far behind. He wouldn't try anything in front of all these people, would he? I shook my head to flush out the thought, and concentrated instead on where I was going. I'd been to Delphic only 3 or 4 times before, always at night, and I didn't know the layout well. I could have kicked myself for not grabbing a map on my way in. I found it absurdly ironic that 30 seconds ago I'd been running away from the exit. Now getting to it was the only thing on my mind. "Hey, watch out!"
"Excuse me," I said breathless.
"Which way to the exit?"
"Where's the fire, man?"
I fought my way past the crowd. "Excuse me, I have to get through, excuse me!" Above the hedges, the lights of the rides blazed and glittered against the backdrop of night. I paused at an intersection, trying to orient myself. Left or right? Which would get me to the exit faster?
"There you are!"
Scott's breath warmed my ear. He laid his hand on my neck, sending a spike of chills ricocheting to the bone.
"Help!" I shouted on instinct. "Someone help me!"
"My girlfriend," Scott explained to the few people who'd paused long enough to direct their attention at us. "This is a game we play."
"I'm not his girlfriend," I shouted in a panic. "Get your hands off me!"
"Come here, sweetheart."
Scott wrestled me into his arms, pinning me against him.
"I warned you not to lie to me," he murmured in my ear. "I need the ring. I don't want to hurt you, Nora, but I will if you make me."
"Get him off me!"
I shouted to anyone who would listen. Scott wrenched my arm behind my back. I spoke through gritted teeth, trying to battle the pain.
"Are you insane?" I said. "I don't have the ring. I gave it to the police last night. Go get it from them."
"Quit lying," he growled.
"Call them yourself. It's the truth. I gave it to them. I don't have it."
I shut my eyes, praying he believed me and released my arm.
"Then you're going to help me get it back."
"They aren't going to give it to me. It's evidence. I told them it was your ring.
They'll give it back, he said slowly, as if he was forming a plan as he went. If I trade you for the ring.
It all clicked into place.
You're going to hold me hostage? Trade me for the ring? Help! I screamed. Somebody get him off me!
One of the people standing nearby laughed.
This isn't a joke, I yelled, feeling blood rise in my neck, terror and desperation scraping away at me. Get him off!
Scott sealed his hand over my mouth, but I got my foot up and kicked him in the shin. He gave a grunt of pain and buckled in half. His arms loosened slightly in the surprise of the attack, and I shoved myself free. I fumbled back a step, watching agony twist on his face, then turned and bolted, seeing glimpses of the rides through the gaps in the crowd. All I had to do was make it out. The police had to be close, then I'd be safe. Safe. I repeated the word frantically as motivation to keep my head and not succumb to panic. There was a wan light left in the western sky, and I used it to orient myself north. If I continued north, the pathway would eventually deliver me to the gates. An explosion shattered my ear. It startled me so much I tripped and went down on my knees. Or maybe I'd acted reflexively, because there were others around me who'd dropped to the pavement, too. There was a moment of hair-raising quiet, and then everyone was screaming and scrambling in every direction. He's got a gun! The words blurred together in my ears, sounding so very far away. Even though not one part of me wanted to, I found myself turning back. Scott was clutching his side, bright red liquid flowering through his shirt. His mouth was open, his eyes wide with shock. He went down on one knee, and I saw someone standing several yards behind him holding a gun. Rickson. V was at his side, her hands clamped over her mouth, her face as white as a sheet. There was a chaotic stampede of feet and limbs and panicked, chilling screams, and I scooted to the side of the path, trying to avoid getting trampled on. "He's getting away!" I heard V shriek. "Someone get him!" Rickson fired several shots, but this time nobody dropped. In fact, the rush to get out intensified. I pulled myself to standing and looked back to where I'd last seen Rickson and V. The echo of the shots still pealed in my ears, but I read the words as they fell from Rickson's lips. "Over here." He flagged his free arm through the air. In what felt like slow motion, I fought the stream of traffic and ran to him. "What the hell?" V shrieked. "Why did you shoot him, Rickson?"
"Citizen's arrest," he said. "Well, that and Patch told me to."
"You can't shoot people just because Patch says to," V said, her eyes wild. "You're going to get arrested. What are we going to do now?" she moaned.
"The police are on their way," I said. "They know about Scott."
"We have to get out of here," said V, still hysterical, flapping her arms and pacing a few feet, only to spin back and come back to where she'd started.
"I'll take Nora to the police station. Rickson, go get Scott, but don't shoot him again. Tie him up like last time."
"Nora can't use the gates," Rickson said. "That's what he'll expect. I know another way out. V, get the neon and meet us at the south end of the parking lot, near the dumpsters."
"How are you going to get out?" V wanted to know.
"Through the underground tunnels."
"There are tunnels under Delphic?" V asked.
Rickson kissed her forehead. "Hurry, love."
The crowd had scattered, leaving the pathway empty. I could still hear panicked shrieks and screams echoing down the walkway, but they sounded a world away. V hesitated a moment, then gave a resolute nod. "Just hurry, okay?"
"There's a mechanical room in the basement of the funhouse," Rickson explained to me as we walked in a hurry down the opposite pathway. "It has a door leading into the tunnels under Delphic. Scott may have heard of the tunnels, but if he figures out where we've gone and follows us, there's no way he'll find us. It's like a maze down there, and it goes on for miles."
He gave a nervous smile.
"Don't worry. Delphic was built by fallen angels. Not me in particular, but a few of my mates helped. I know the routes by heart. Mostly."
Chapter 23. As we drew closer to the grinning clown's head leading inside the funhouse, the distant screams were replaced by creepy music box carnival music, tinkling loudly from the bowels of the funhouse. I stepped through the mouth and the floor shifted. I reached out to steady myself, but the walls turned, rolling under my hands.
As my eyes adjusted to the traces of light filtering through the mouth of the clown behind me, I saw that I was inside a revolving barrel that seemed to stretch on forever. The barrel was painted with alternating stripes of red and white, and they blurred together into a dizzying pink.
"Here,"
Rickson said, guiding me through the barrel. I put one foot in front of the other, sliding and blundering forward. At the end, I stepped out to solid ground, only to have a jet of icy air shoot up from the floor. The cold licked my skin, and I jumped sideways with a startled gasp.
"It's not real," Rickson assured me. "We have to keep going. If Scott decides to search the tunnels, we have to beat him inside."
The air was stale and humid and smelled of rust. The clown's head was a distant memory now. The only light came from red bulbs in the cavernous ceiling that blazed to life just long enough to spotlight a dangling skeleton, unraveling zombie, or vampire rising from a coffin.
"How much farther?"
I asked Rickson over the distorted cacophony of hoots, cackles, and wails that echoed all around.
"The mechanical room is just ahead. After that, we'll be in the tunnels. Scott's bleeding pretty bad. He won't die. Patch has told you all about Nephilim, right? But he could pass out from loss of blood. Chances are he won't find an entrance to the tunnels before he does. We'll be back above ground before you know it."
His confidence sounded slightly inflated, a little too optimistic. We pushed on, and I felt the eerie sensation that we were being followed. I spun back, but the darkness was consuming. If someone was back there, I couldn't see.
"Do you think Scott could have followed us?"
I asked Rickson, keeping my voice low. Rickson stopped, turned back, listened. After a moment, he said with certainty, "There's no one there." We were continuing our hurried pace toward the mechanical room when I once again felt a presence behind me. My scalp tingled, and I cut a look over my shoulder. This time the outline of a face materialized through the darkness. I almost cried out, and then the outline solidified into a distinct and familiar face. My dad. His blonde hair was bright against the darkness, his eyes shining, yet sad. "I love you."
"Dad?"
I whispered, but I took a cautionary step back. I reminded myself of the last times. He was a trick, a lie. "I'm sorry I had to leave you and your mom." I willed him to disappear. He wasn't real. He was a threat. He wanted to hurt me. I remembered the way he'd yanked my arm through the townhouse window and tried to cut me. I remembered how he'd chased me through the library. But his voice was the same gentle coaxing he'd used that very first time at the townhouse. Not the stern, sharp voice that had replaced it. It was his voice. "I love you, Nora. Whatever happens, promise me you'll remember that. I don't care how or why you came into my life, only that you did. I don't remember all the things I did wrong. I remember what I did right. I remember you. You made my life meaningful. You made my life special." I shook my head, trying to sweep out his voice, wondering why Rickson wasn't saying anything. Couldn't he see my dad? Wasn't there anything we could do to make him go away? But the truth of the matter was, I didn't want his voice to stop. I didn't want him to leave. I wanted him to be real. I needed him to wrap his arms around me and tell me everything was going to be all right. Most of all, I longed for him to come home. "Promise you'll remember." Tears dripped down my cheeks. "I promise," I thought back, even though I knew he couldn't hear me. "An angel of death helped me come here to see you. She's holding time still for us, Nora. She's helping me speak to your mind. There's something important I need to tell you, but I don't have much time. I have to go back soon, and I need you to listen carefully."
"No," I choked, my voice coming out strangled. "I'm going with you. Don't leave me here. I'm going with you. You can't leave me again."
"I can't stay, baby. I belong somewhere else now."
"Please don't go,"
I sobbed, clutching my fists against my chest as if I could stop my heart from swelling. A certain desperate panic seized me when I thought of him leaving again. My sheer sense of abandonment outweighed everything else. He was going to leave me here, in the funhouse, in the dark with no one to help me but Rickson.
"Why are you leaving me all over again? I need you."
Touch Rickson's scars. The truth is there. My dad's face receded into the darkness. I reached out to stop him, but his face turned into a ribbon of fog at my touch. The silvery white threads dissolved into the darkness. Nora? I started at the sound of Rickson's voice.
We have to hurry, he said, as if no more than a ripple of time had passed. We don't want to meet up with Scott in the outer ring of the tunnels where all the entrances feed.
My dad was gone. For reasons I couldn't explain, I knew I'd seen him for the last time. The pain and loss was unbearable. At the moment when I needed him most, when I was heading into the tunnels, scared and lost, he'd left me to face this alone.
I can't see where I'm going,
I gasped, swatting my eyes dry, struggling through the frustrating process of trying to focus my thoughts on one specific goal, getting to the tunnels and meeting V on the other side. I need something to hold. Rickson impatiently thrust the hem of his shirt out to me.
Hold the back of my shirt and follow me. Keep up, we haven't got a lot of time.
I squeezed the worn cotton between my fingers, my heart beating stronger. Inches away was the bare skin of his back. My dad had told me to touch his scars. It would be so easy now. All I had to do was slide my hand. Succumb to the dark suction that would swallow me whole. I thought back to the times I'd touched Patch's scars, and how I'd been briefly transported inside his memory. Without a shred of doubt, I knew touching Rickson's scars would do the same thing. I didn't want to go. I wanted to keep my feet under me, get to the tunnels, and get out of Delphic. But my dad had come back to tell me where to find the truth. Whatever I'd see in Rickson's past, it had to be important. As much as it hurt to know my dad had left me here, I had to trust him. I had to trust he'd risked everything to tell me. I slid my hand up the back of Rickson's shirt. I felt smooth skin, then a bumpy ridge of scar tissue. I splayed my hand against the scar, waiting to be ripped into a strange, foreign world. The street was quiet, dark. The houses framing both sides of it were derelict, ramshackle. Yards were small and fenced, windows were boarded or barred. A heavy frost sank its teeth into my skin. Two loud explosions ruptured the silence. I swung to face the house across the street. Gunshots? I thought in a panic. I immediately searched through my pockets for my cell phone, meaning to call 911, when I remembered I was trapped in Rickson's memory. Everything I was seeing had happened in the past. I couldn't change anything now. The sound of running footsteps rang through the night, and I watched in shock as my dad let himself through the gate of the house across the street and disappeared around the side yard. Without waiting, I took off after him.
Dad!
I screamed, unable to help myself. Don't go back there! He was wearing the same clothes he'd gone out in the night he'd been killed. I pushed through the gate and met him at the back corner of the house. Sobbing, I threw my arms around him. We have to go back. We have to get out of here. Something horrible is going to happen. My dad walked right through my arms, crossing to a small stone wall that ran alongside the property. He inched down the wall in a crouch, eyes trained on the back door of the house. I leaned into the siding, bowed my head against my arms, and cried. I didn't want to see this. Why had my dad told me to touch Rickson's scars? I didn't want this. Didn't he know how much pain I'd already suffered?
Last chance.
The words were spoken from inside the house, drifting out through the open back door.
Go to hell.
Another explosion and I slumped to my knees, pressing myself against the siding, willing the memory to end.
Where is she?
The question was asked so quietly, so calmly, I almost couldn't hear it over my soft crying. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw my dad move. He crept across the yard, moving toward the door. A gun was in his hand, and he raised it, taking aim. I ran at him, grabbing at his hands, trying to wrestle the gun away from him, trying to push him back into the shadows. But it was like moving a ghost. My hands passed right through him. My dad pulled the trigger. The shot cut open the night, ripping the silence in half. Again and again he fired. Even though no part of me wanted to, I faced the house, seeing the lean build of the young man my dad was shooting from behind. Just beyond him, another man sat slumped on the floor, his back propped up by the sofa. He was bleeding, and his expression was twisted in agony and fear. In a moment muddled with confusion, I realized it was Hank Miller.
Run! Hank shouted at my dad. Leave me behind! Run and save yourself!
My dad didn't run. He held the gun level, shooting over and over, sending bullets flying at the open door.
where the young man in a blue ball cap seemed impervious to them. And then, very slowly, he turned to face my dad.
Chapter 24. Rickson grabbed my wrist, giving it a firm squeeze.
Careful whose business you go sticking your nose in.
His jaw was set in anger, his nostrils flaring slightly.
Maybe that's the way it is with Patch, but nobody touches my scars.
He arched his eyebrows meaningfully. My stomach was cinched with a knot so tight I almost doubled over.
I saw my dad die, I blurted, stricken with horror. Did you see the killer?
Rickson asked, shaking my wrist to pull me all the way back to the present.
I saw Patch from behind, I gasped. He was wearing his ball cap.
He nodded as if accepting that what I'd seen couldn't be undone.
He didn't want to keep the truth from you, but he knew that if he told you, he'd lose you. It happened before he knew you. I don't care when it happened, I said, my voice shrill and shaking. He needs to be brought to justice.
You can't bring him to justice. He's Patch.
If you report him, do you really think he's going to let the cops haul him off?
No, I didn't. The police meant nothing to Patch. Only the Archangels could stop him. There's just one thing I don't understand. There were only three people in the memory. My dad, Patch, and Hank Miller. The three of them saw what happened. Then how am I seeing this in your memory?
Rickson didn't say anything, but the lines around his mouth tightened.
A horrible new thought settled over me. All certainty in regard to my dad's killer evaporated. I'd seen the killer from the back and assumed it was Patch because of the ball cap. But the longer I dwelled on the memory, the more I was sure the killer was too lanky to be Patch. The cut of his shoulders, too angular. In fact, the killer looked a lot like...
You killed him, I whispered.
It was you. You were wearing Patch's hat.
The shock of the moment was quickly being eaten up by abhorrence and ice-cold fear.
You killed my dad.
Any trace of kindness or sympathy vanished from Rickson's eyes.
Well, this is awkward.
You were wearing Patch's hat that night. You borrowed it, didn't you? You couldn't kill my dad without assuming another identity. You couldn't do it unless you removed yourself from the situation.
I said, drawing on everything I remembered from the psychology unit in my freshman health class.
No, wait, that's not it. You pretended to be Patch because you wish you were him. You're jealous of him, that's it, isn't it? You'd rather be him.
Rickson gripped my cheekbones, forcing me to stop.
Shut up!
I recoiled, my jaw aching where he'd squeezed me. I wanted to fling myself at him, hitting him with everything I had, but I knew I needed to stay calm. I needed to find out what I could. I was beginning to think Rickson hadn't brought me into the tunnels to help me escape. Worse, I was beginning to think he had no intention of ever taking me back up.
Jealous of him, he said cruelly. Sure, I'm jealous. He isn't the one on the fast track to hell. We were in this together, and now he's gone and gotten himself his wings back.
His eyes raked over me in disgust.
Because of you.
I shook my head, not buying it.
You killed my dad before you even knew who I was.
He laughed, but it lacked humor.
I knew you were out there somewhere, and I was looking for you.
Why? Rickson slipped the gun out from under his shirt and used it to motion deeper into the funhouse.
Keep walking.
Where are we going? He didn't answer. The police are on their way.
Hang the police, Rickson said. I'll be finished before they get here.
Finished? Stay calm, I told myself. Stall. You're going to kill me now that I know the truth? Now that I know you killed my dad?
Harrison Gray wasn't your dad.
I opened my mouth, but the argument I expected to come flying out didn't. The one image splayed across the forefront of my mind was of Marcy standing in her front yard, telling me Hank Miller could be my father. I felt my stomach heave. Did this mean Marcy was telling the truth? For 16 years, I'd been kept in the dark about the truth behind my family. I wondered if my dad had known, my real dad, Harrison Gray, the man who'd raised and loved me, not my biological father who'd abandoned me, not Hank Miller, who could go to hell for all I cared.
Your dad is in a field named Barnabas, Rickson said. More recently, he goes by Hank Miller.
No. I stepped sideways, dizzy with the truth. The dream. Patch's dream. It was a real memory. He hadn't been lying. Barnabas, Hank Miller, was Nephilim. And he was my father. My world threatened to crash down around me, but I forced myself to stay in the moment a little longer. In the far back of my mind, I shook my memory, frantically trying to remember where I'd heard the name Barnabas before. I couldn't place it, but I knew this wasn't the first time I'd heard it. It was too unusual to forget. Barnabas. 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 I grappled to fit two loose ends together. Why was Rickson telling me this? Why did he know about my biological father? Why did he care? And then it hit me. Once, when I'd touched Patch's scars and gone into his memory, I'd heard him talk about his Nephil vassal, Chauncey Langer. He'd also talked about Rickson's vassal, Barnabas. No, I whispered, the word slipping out. I desperately wanted to run, but my legs were wooden, stiff as posts. When Hank got your mum pregnant, he'd heard enough rumors about the Book of Enoch to worry that I'd come looking for the baby, especially if it was a girl. So he did the only thing he could. He hid her. You. When Hank told his mate, Harrison Gray, that your mum was in trouble, he agreed to marry her and pretend you were his. No, no, no. But I'm descended from Chauncey. On my father's side, on Harrison Gray's side, I have a mark on my wrist that proves it. Aye, you do. Many centuries ago, Chauncey entertained a naive farm girl. She had a son. Nobody thought anything particular about the boy, or his sons, or their sons, and so on through the ages, until one of the sons slept with a woman outside of wedlock. He injected the noble Nephilim blood of his ancestor, the Duke of Langer, into another line. The line that eventually produced Barnabas, or Hank, as he seems to prefer recently. Rickson gestured impatiently for me to put two and two together. I already had. You're saying both Harrison and Hank have Chauncey's Nephilim blood, I said. And Hank, a purebred first-generation Nephil, was immortal, while my own dad's Nephilim blood, diluted over centuries just like mine, was not. Hank, a man I hardly knew and respected even less, could live forever, while my dad was gone forever. I am love. Don't call me love. You'd prefer angel. He was making fun of me, toying with me, because he had me right where he wanted. I'd been through this once before with Patch, and I knew what was coming. Hank Miller was my biological father and Rickson's Nephil vassal. Rickson was going to sacrifice me to kill Hank Miller and get a human body. Do I get any last-minute answers? I asked, my tone edging toward challenging in spite of my fear. He shrugged. Why not? I thought only first-generation, purebred Nephilim could swear fealty. In order for Hank to be first-generation, he'd have to have a human and a fallen angel parent. But his father wasn't a fallen angel. He was one of Chauncey's male descendants. You're overlooking the fact that men can have affairs with female fallen angels. I shook my head. Fallen angels don't have human bodies. Females can't give birth, Patch told me. But a female fallen angel, possessing a female human body during Cheshvan, can produce a baby. The human may give birth to the baby long after Cheshvan, but the baby is tainted. It was conceived by a fallen angel. That's revolting. He smiled faintly. I agree. Out of morbid curiosity, when you sacrifice me, does your body just become human, or do you possess another human body for good? I become human. His mouth curved slightly. So if you come back to haunt me from the grave, just know you'll be looking for my same handsome mug. Patch could show up any minute now and stop you, I said, trying to be strong, but unable to stop the unbearable shaking in every limb of my body. His eyes laughed at me. I had my work cut out, but I'm confident I drove the wedge between the two of you about as deep as it could go. You got the ball rolling by breaking up with him. I couldn't have planned it better myself. Then there was the constant fighting, your jealousy over Marcy, and Patch's card, which I drugged to toss in just one more seed of distrust. When I stole the ring from Barnabas and had it delivered to you at the bakery, I had no doubt Patch was the last person you'd run to. Swallow your pride and ask for his help. When you thought he was hooked up with Marcy, not a chance. You played right into my hands when you asked me if he was the Black Hand. I made the evidence against him overwhelming when I answered that yes, he He was. Then I took advantage of the turn in our conversation to mention the address of one of Barnabas's Nephilim safe houses as Patches, knowing full well he'd go snooping around and probably find memorabilia from the Black Hand. I canceled the movie plans last night, not Patch. I didn't want to be stuck inside a movie theater while you were all alone in the apartment. I needed to follow you. I planted the dynamite once you were inside, hoping to sacrifice you, but you got away.
I'm touched, Rickson. A bomb. How elaborate. Why didn't you keep things simple and just march inside my bedroom one night and put a bullet between my eyes?
He spread his hands in front of him.
This is a big moment for me, Nora. Can you blame me for wanting a little flourish?
I tried posing as Harrison's ghost to lure you close, thinking how fantastic it would be to send you to the grave thinking your own father had killed you. But you didn't trust me. You kept running away.
He frowned a little. You're a psychopath.
I prefer creative.
What else was a lie? At the beach, did you tell me Patch was still my guardian angel?
To lull you into a false sense of security?
Yes.
And the blood oath?
A spur-of-the-moment lie, just to keep things interesting.
So basically you're telling me nothing you've ever said to me was true.
Except the part about sacrificing you. I was dead serious about that. Enough talk, and let's get on with this.
Using the gun, he shoved me deeper into the funhouse. The rough prod tipped me off balance, and I stepped sideways to catch my footing, landing on a section of floor that began undulating up and down. I felt Rickson grab for my wrist to steady me, only something went wrong. His hand slipped down over mine. I heard the soft thud of his body landing. The sound seemed to come from directly below. A thought brushed my mind, that he'd fallen down one of the many trapdoors rumored to be scattered throughout the funhouse. But I didn't stay around long enough to see if I'd guessed right. I bolted back the way we'd come, searching for the clown head. A figure sprang out in front of me, a light flashing overhead to illuminate a blood-soaked axe wedged in a bearded pirate's head. He leered at me a moment before his eyes rolled back in his head and the light faded. I drew several sharp breaths, telling myself it was pretend, but unable to steady myself as the floor quaked and shifted under my shoes. I went down on my knees, crawling over the grime and grit pressing into my palms, trying to calm my head, which seemed to tilt with the floors. I crawled for several feet, not wanting to stop moving long enough to let Rickson find a way out of the trap door.
Nora!
Rickson's rough bark carried up behind me. I pulled myself up, using the walls to support me, but the walls were coated in slime that oozed onto my hands. Somewhere overhead, laughter boomed, tapering off to a cackle. I shook my hands hard to slough off the slime. Then I fished my way into the sheer blackness that lay ahead. I was lost. 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 I jogged a few steps forward, rounded a turn, and squinted at the faint glow of orange light several yards down the path. It wasn't the clown's head, but I was drawn to the promise of light like a moth. When I reached the lantern, the tacky Halloweenish light illuminated the words, Tunnel of Doom. I was standing on a boat dock. Small plastic boats were parked nose to bumper, water from the canal lapping their sides. I heard footsteps on the path behind me. With no time to second guess, I stepped into the boat closest to me. I'd just found my balance when the boat lurched into motion, jerking me down onto the slat of wood that served as a seat. The boats were moving in a single-file line, the tracks below clacking as they steered the boats into the tunnel ahead. A pair of saloon-style doors flung open, swallowing my boat into the tunnel. Feeling my way to the front of the boat, I climbed over the safety bar and onto the bow. I stayed there a moment, one hand anchoring me to the boat, while my other hand reached ahead, trying to grab the rear bar of the boat one up. I was a few inches short. I would have to jump. I scooted up the bow as far as I dared. I tucked my legs under me, then leaped, managing to skid onto the back of the next boat up. I allowed myself one moment of relief, then went back to work. Once again, I moved up the bow with the intention of jumping boats all the way to the end of the ride. Rickson was bigger and faster, and he had a gun. My only hope of survival was to keep moving, to keep drawing out the time it took for him to catch me. I was on the next bow, preparing to jump, when a siren blasted and the sudden illumination of a red light overhead blinded me. A skeleton dropped from the ceiling of the tunnel, smacking into me. I lost my footing and felt a wash of vertigo as I skidded sideways, overboard. Frigid water rushed through my clothes, closing over my head. Instantly, I put my feet down, broke the water's surface, and waded through the chest-deep water back to the boat. Gritting my teeth against the cold, I clamped my hands around the boat's safety bar and hauled myself back inside. Several loud shots ricocheted through the tunnel, one of the bullets whizzing past my ear. I dropped low in the boat, while Rickson's laugh carried from a few boats back. "A matter of time," he called. More lights were flashing overhead, and between the pulses of light I could see Rickson making his way across the boats toward me. A faint roar sounded somewhere ahead. My stomach slid out from beneath me. I felt my concentration peel away from Rickson and shift to the spray of moisture in the air. My heart stopped for half a moment, then started pounding much too hard. Grabbing hold of the metal bar, I braced myself for the fall. The front of the boat tipped, then plunged over the waterfall. The boat splashed at the bottom, sending water spraying over the sides. The water might have felt cold had I not already been drenched and shivering. I wiped my eyes dry, and that was when I saw a small maintenance platform carved out of the tunnel wall to my right. A door marked Danger High Voltage sat just back from the platform. I looked back at the waterfall. Rickson's boat hadn't fallen yet, and with only seconds to spare, I made a risky decision. Jumping over the side of the boat, I waded as quickly as I could to the platform, hoisted myself up, and tried the door. It opened, letting out the loud hissing and clanking of machines, hundreds of gears churning and grinding. I'd found the mechanical heart of the funhouse, and the entrance to the underground tunnels. I closed the door most of the way behind me, leaving a thin crack to see out. With one eye pressed to the crack, I watched the next boat fly down the waterfall. Rickson was in the boat. He was leaning over the metal sidebar, searching the water. Had he seen me jump out? Was he looking for me? His boat continued down the track, and he eased himself overboard, landing feet first in the water. Using his hands to hold his wet hair out of his face, he searched the murky surface of the water. It was then that I realized his hands were empty. He wasn't looking for me. He dropped the gun in the fall, and he was looking for it. The tunnel was dark, and I found it impossible to believe Rickson could see all the way to the bottom of the canal, which meant he was going to have to feel his way to the gun. That would take time. Of course, I needed more than time. I needed a stroke of impossible luck. The police had to be combing the park by now, but would they think to look in the underbelly of the funhouse before it was too late? I shut the door softly, hoping to find a lock on the inside, but there was none. Suddenly, I wished I'd risked my chances making it out of the tunnel before Rickson, rather than circling back to hide. If Rickson came inside the service room, I was trapped. Ragged breathing came from my left, behind an electrical box. I swung around, eyes darting through the blackness. Who's there? Who do you think? I blinked against the shadows. Scott? I took several nervous steps backward. I got lost in the tunnels. I took a door and came out in here. Are you still bleeding? Yeah. Surprisingly, I'm not completely drained yet. His words were choppy, and I could tell it took a lot of energy for him to speak. You need a doctor. He gave a spent laugh. I need the ring. At this point, I didn't know how serious Scott was about getting the ring back. He was exhausted with pain, and I was pretty sure we both knew he wasn't going to drag me out of here to hold as a hostage. He was weakened by the shot, but he was Nephilim. He would survive this. Working together, we had a chance at getting out. But before I could convince him to help me escape Rickson, I needed him to trust me. I walked over to the electrical box and knelt down beside him. He had one hand pressed against his side, just below his ribcage, stopping the flow of blood. His face was the color of cornstarch, and the wasted look in his eyes proved what I already knew. He was in a lot of pain. "I don't believe you're going to use the ring to recruit new members," I said quietly. "You aren't going to force other people into the society." Scott shook his head, agreeing with me. "There's something I need to tell you. Remember when I told you I was working the night your dad was shot?" I vaguely remembered him telling me he'd been at work when he got the call about my dad's murder. "Where's this going?" I asked hesitantly. "I worked at a convenience store called Quickies that was only a few blocks away." He paused as if waiting for me to come to some grand conclusion. "I was supposed to follow your dad that night. The Black Hand told me to.
He said your dad was on his way to a meeting, and I had to keep him safe.
What are you saying? I asked in a voice as dry as chalk.
I didn't follow him.